Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace and author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, who talks about the dangerous consequences provoked by the U.S. drone warfare program. Dylan Voorhees of the Natural Resources Council of Maine, who explains why protesters will be gathering in Portland on January 26th to oppose plans to pump tar sands oil via an existing pipeline from Canada to New England states. And Tim Sullivan, policy coordinator with United for a Fair Economy, who discusses his group's just-released report titled State of the Dream 2013, A Long Way From Home. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
French military intervention to stop the advance of Al-Qaeda-linked militants in the African nation of Mali led to a new crisis in January as Islamic militants in neighboring Algeria retaliated by seizing foreign hostages at a large natural gas facility. A raid by the Algerian military on the complex led to the death of 37 foreign captives and 29 extremists. Since a military coup in Mali last spring, the West African country has seen Tuareg separatists and Islamic militias take control of the northern half of the country. Islamic fighters linked to Al-Qaeda set up a harsh form of Sharia law and opened training camps attracting foreign militants. In December, the United Nations Security Council approved an African-led fighting force to intervene in Mali, but no action was planned to take place until this fall. French President François Hollande declared his nation had to act as Islamic forces launched an offensive and took over several towns 200 miles from Mali's capital city of Bamako. African troops from Nigeria and Togo arrived to help the French, which ruled Mali until 1960, while troops from Chad, Niger, and Burkina Faso are expected to arrive soon. In response to the crisis, the Obama White House ramped up counter-terror activities in northern Africa, including the launch of drone strikes and mobilization of special operations teams against Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. In the bustling city of Accra, the capital of Ghana, the five-star Movenpick Hotel opened in 2011, backed by money from Saudi Arabia. The hotel offers 260 luxury rooms with thousands of square feet of high-end retail stores. Among the investors in the Accra hotel complex was the World Bank's private investment arm, the International Finance Corporation, or IFC, whose mission is to provide affordable loans in the developing world. Many critics are wondering what the IFC was doing, bankrolling a $26 million loan to a luxury hotel investment company owned by Saudi Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, who has a net worth of $18 billion. ProPublica, the investigative journal, says the answer rests with IFC's desire to reduce risky loans and maximize profits to bolster its loan portfolio. In more than 100 countries around the globe, the IFC has a history of working with big corporations, including ExxonMobil, and billionaires to finance deals that would likely attract commercial funding. IFC also funds many dirty energy projects, including oil pipelines and gold and copper mines. A harsh review by the World Bank's Internal Evaluation Unit concluded that over half of IFC loans had nothing to do with fighting poverty, with only 13% of the funds dedicated to poverty reduction. On an impulse, New Orleans teenager Pershelle Richardson grabbed her neighbor's iPhone and ran home. The police soon arrested the high school student on felony charges. Because her family could not afford bail, she spent the next 51 days in jail, missing weeks of school, waiting for a court date. The teenager was later released into a diversion program and was never convicted of a crime. According to the Christian Science Monitor, millions of low-income Americans sit for weeks in local and county jails because they cannot afford bail. Today, it's estimated that two-thirds of jail inmates are waiting for trials, unable to pay bail. The Pretrial Justice Institute reports that over 90% of people held in local jails never end up in prison. Most are either acquitted of their charges, given probation, or enrolled in rehabilitation programs. Brigham Young Law School professor Shima Berdaran says the overwhelming majority of people in our nation's jails are not a threat to society. Most are detained for minor offenses and simply do not have the money to get out of jail. Over the last two decades, the imposition of surety bonds by judges has increased to 70% of all cases. However, the use of bail varies widely by jurisdiction. In Greater Houston, Texas, for example, only 5% of defendants are released without bail. But in Austin, judges release over 60% of offenders without the condition of a bond. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the days just before Barack Obama took the oath of office to begin his second term as president, the U.S. launched drone strikes in Yemen that reportedly killed 15 people. The administration's escalation of America's use of unmanned aerial vehicles in its targeted killing of suspected terrorists across the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa is provoking increased opposition at home and abroad. During the inauguration ceremonies in Washington, D.C., the group Code Pink Women for Peace protested against the U.S. drone program and called on the Senate to reject President Obama's nomination of John Brennan to head the CIA. Brennan, who is currently Deputy National Security Advisor and Assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, is the architect of Obama's drone program and is referred to by some as the nation's assassination czar. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, was part of her group's recent 34-member delegation of Americans that visited Pakistan in October with the goal of witnessing firsthand the damage wrought by U.S. drone strikes there. While in Pakistan's tribal Waziristan region, delegates met with Pakistani families who have been victims of U.S. drone strikes and participated in a one-day fast in memory of the estimated 450 to 800 civilians, including 160 children, killed by U.S. drones since 2004. Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, who's the author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Here she explains why Code Pink and a growing number of other citizens are opposed to the nation's drone program and why she's working to defeat Barack Obama's nomination of John Brennan to head the CIA.
In the case of northern Pakistan, where we visited, and it's an area that hadn't seen Americans there for about 10 years, the people are terrorized by these drones. They're afraid to send their children to school. They're afraid to go to the markets. They're afraid to go to community gatherings like weddings and funerals. They're afraid to have the traditional jirgas, which is a gathering of the elders of the community to try to solve local disputes. It's sown a distrust in the community because people wonder, well, who is it that is providing the information to the CIA that will put people on a kill list? And so people are distrusting their neighbors. And then once there is a drone strike, there is another group related to the Taliban that comes in and kills anybody they think might have been the informants. There have been thousands and thousands of people who have fled their homes because of the drones and become refugees. So it is really disturbing the entire way of life in the areas where it's being used.
Last April, you and others protested at the Woodrow Wilson International Center when John Brennan spoke there in defense of drone warfare. What was the point you were trying to raise? And certainly this is a good time to talk about your opposition to President Obama's nomination for him to head the CIA.
In April, we did a drone summit, Scott, where we brought several hundred people into Washington from various communities, the human rights communities, women's groups, groups that work on issues of war and peace, and folks came in from Pakistan, from Yemen, and we all started talking about what was happening and what we could do. And it was right at the last day of that drone summit, in fact, the next day, coincidentally, that John Brennan was going to speak out for the first time, really, publicly, trying to justify the drones. And I got in there really just almost by accident and listened to him talk about how the Taliban were responsible for the killing of innocent people and Al-Qaeda. And I felt compelled after hearing so many stories just the day before that I should get up and speak on behalf of some of the victims that the United States has killed. And so I got to talk out about people like Tariq Aziz, who had been killed for trying to document drone strikes, or the 16-year-old Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki, who is the son of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American who is a radical cleric that President Obama had put on a kill list. But several weeks later, his son was killed, a 16-year-old born in Denver. And so we were just giving some examples. But the larger question is that it has been John Brennan, who has been the CIA architect of this drone program under the Obama administration, that has led to a huge rise in the number of drones being used by the Obama administration, that went from about 50 drones being used under Bush in Pakistan to over 300 used by the Obama administration, and then pushing this program into Yemen, where we've seen a tremendous increase in the number of drone strikes. Now, the important thing to know about the drones, Scott, is that they not only kill a lot of innocent people, despite the fact that John Brennan said in 2011 that not one civilian had been killed, and then revised it later to say that it was in the single digits, but also important to know how counterproductive these drones are, because they create enemies faster than we can kill them. In fact, it's become the biggest recruiting tool for al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And when we were in Pakistan, we were amazed to see the visceral kind of hatred of the drones, not only by people in the region they're being used, but by virtually everybody in the country, no matter what political party they were part of, no matter what their political orientation. And there was a poll that showed that 3 out of 4 Pakistanis consider the United States their enemy. So it's really important to understand that these drones are making us less safe, and that's why we're so concerned that when President Obama said he looked around to see who he could tap as head of the CIA, who is somebody that could watch out for the safety of the American people, we're saying that John Brennan is the wrong person for this job. So I'm hoping that with the education work that I am doing with my new book, but that a whole lot of people around the country are doing, and the protests that are building up around Air Force bases around this country, the civil disobedience that people are doing, the protests at the headquarters of drone manufacturers, the pressure that we're starting to put on Congress, that we're going to see a lot more people join us in questioning the drone program and calling for some rules of the game.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. She's the author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Learn more about the growing opposition to the U.S. Drone Warfare Program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On January 26th, hundreds of protesters are expected to converge in Portland, Maine, for what's being billed as the largest tar sands protest in the Northeast. The impetus is what organizers say are plans to reverse the flow of an existing pipeline that currently takes oil from ships arriving in South Portland Harbor and pumps it to Montreal, Canada. Activists say the Canadian company Enbridge is now considering pumping tar sands oil from Alberta through Quebec to Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. Both Enbridge and the Portland Pipeline Corporation, which is owned by ExxonMobil, say such plans were put on hold in 2009. But the National Wildlife Federation has released documents indicating that the proposal is very much an active option. There's widespread opposition to the extraction of tar sands oil because it produces far more greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming than conventional production methods. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dylan Voorhees, Clean Energy and Global Warming Project Director with the Natural Resources Council of Maine, one of the groups that's organizing the protest, along with Environment Maine, 350.org, the National Wildlife Federation, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and other groups. Here, Voorhees explains that despite asserting they have no plans to reverse the pipeline flow, the companies have, in fact, expressed a keen interest in doing just that.
They've actually not said that they don't want to do this. In fact, what they've told public officials in a number of meetings is that they very much would like to do this. But what they are saying also in the public is that they have no plan at this time to do it, which is kind of like saying, I don't have a plan yet for dinner tonight. They admit that they would like to do it because I think the prospect of sending oil into Canada these days is a diminishing market for them. And that's what the pipeline does right now. It takes regular crude oil off of tankers that come into Portland Harbor, and it flows up to Montreal. And it's been doing that for 60 years. But there's a new day in oil, and that's because of tar sands in Canada. And Canada has in the ground enormous amounts of tar sands that oil companies are trying to get out of Canada. That's the situation across Canada, and that's led to the proposals of the Keystone XL pipeline, which would go from Canada down to the Gulf. There's a project proposed for taking tar sands west to British Columbia, and this is really more of the same.
Well, Burlington, Vermont, and Casco, Maine have recently passed resolutions opposing tar sands going through their towns. What, if any, control do towns have over a pipeline going through their territory?
Very little, unfortunately. And the town of Casco, Maine, which is a small town on Sebago Lake, which is one of the larger lakes in the state and is kind of a jewel in the tourism region in southwestern Maine, Casco passed a resolution which expresses the sentiment of the town. It doesn't really have a lot of binding impact, but it says very clearly, and it was an actual vote of the townspeople at a town meeting, that they are opposed to this and they're very concerned about their economy and their environment. And I think that's what we will begin to see from more and more towns across Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont, and we've already seen a little bit in Quebec, towns saying, we don't want this. And hopefully, collectively, that sends a message. But towns don't have a lot of say, and even states may not have a lot of say. What we've been starting to say is that we are calling on the U.S. State Department to require what's called a presidential permit, and that's because the pipeline crosses an international boundary. The State Department is the one that can control permitting. We want to make sure that there will be a presidential permit required before this change happens, and that will enable us to see an environmental review happen. If that doesn't happen, then we're very concerned that this project could go forward without really environmental reviews.
Dylan Voorhees, you know, tar sands is a lot more corrosive than other kinds of oil, and this pipeline is already 60 years old. Are there concerns about spills?
There's a lot of concern in Maine about possible spills from if tar sands was moving through this pipeline. And that's because tar sands has different physical properties from regular crude oil. It's much more viscous. It's much more toxic. It's actually diluted down with very dangerous toxic chemicals. And because of the higher temperatures, higher pressures, and additional corrosiveness, acidity, and abrasives, we think that the dangers is significantly greater. What we particularly know is that tar sands pipelines in the Midwest that have been carrying tar sands for some time have had incidents of spills or leaks at three times the rate of regular oil pipelines per mile of pipeline. Secondly, the consequences of a spill of tar sands are much more damaging than regular crude oil, and that's because it's so thick and it's so heavy and it has these toxic chemicals in it. And the huge tar sand spill in the Kalamazoo River in 2010, which was an Enbridge pipeline, really demonstrated how practically impossible to clean up tar sands is if it spills.
This rally is being billed as the largest tar sands protest in the Northeast. What exactly is your goal in bringing people to Portland on January 26th?
I think the rally is meant to really try and get on the radar that this is a very serious issue and that the public, not just from Maine, but from across the region, really don't want to see this happen and are calling on elected officials, you know, first and foremost, to act on the people's behalf and really make sure, as a first order, that there's an environmental review before this happens. And that's sort of common sense, but it's not a foregone conclusion that there would even be a real permitting and environmental review process for this change.
That was Dylan Voorhees of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. Find more information on the campaigns to stop the development and transport of tar sands oil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and work this year coincided with President Obama's second inauguration on January 21st. Because Obama is America's first African-American president, King's lifelong struggle for racial equality was prominently discussed in the coverage of the day's events. But while not as much focused on by corporate media and mainstream politicians, King was also very much active in the fight against economic inequality. In fact, in his April 4, 1967 speech, "Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam," delivered exactly 1 year before his assassination, King discussed the urgent need to battle the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation. In a new report published on this year's Martin Luther King holiday, the group United for a Fair Economy focused on King's unfinished work addressing economic disparity. Their report, titled State of the Dream 2013, A Long Way From Home, assessed the impact of the Great Recession with its string of foreclosures and crash of home values on the growing racial wealth divide. The report found that the average white family holds significantly greater wealth than the average black or Latino family, and housing wealth comprises a far greater share of total assets for black and Latino families than for their white counterparts. Your reporter spoke with Tim Sullivan, policy coordinator with United for a Fair Economy and co-author of the State of the Dream report. Here he discusses the conclusions of the report and summarizes some of the recommendations made for changes in public policy as they affect housing and strategies for building wealth in communities of color.
What we looked at specifically is how people of color, black and Latino families and white families, how they've fared since the Great Recession, and we found that there's a very disparate racial impact, which has a lot to do with where and how people hold their assets. What was really at the core of this recession that began in 2007 was a housing bubble. And the result of that is that this housing bubble burst and housing value declined dramatically. So if for families whose wealth was more connected to their housing than other assets, like, say, the stock market, their wealth declined more. The housing market has not come back the way that the stock market has. And what we found is that people of color, black families and Latino families, and people with lower levels of wealth, more of it is tied to their housing on average. You know, obviously, not everybody's a homeowner, but throughout communities, poorer communities have more of their wealth connected to their first home. And when the housing values decreased, more and more people found that they owed more against their house than it was actually worth. They were unable to sell it if they needed to access that money, which is a major problem with having wealth tied to housing to too great a degree, and ended up poorer than they were relative to families who were able to hold assets in stocks and bonds and bank accounts. And like I said, the housing market has not rebounded the same way that the stock market has. So the recovery has been very uneven, and people who hold a lot of stocks, which are wealthier people, have done, relatively speaking, well since the recovery, as it is, began in around 2010, 2009, I believe, is when the recovery technically began. But it's been very rough for people who need to sell their house or, in order to access their wealth, need to borrow against their house. It's been very tough for people who aren't homeowners as well. And we have a lot of policy supports for home ownership that has gotten people into a lot of good situations. It has had benefits for individuals, for families and communities, but it also has this drawback of, if that's where your wealth is, when the housing market as a whole goes down, you're in some fairly serious trouble.
Tim, what's the relative disparity between blacks, whites, and Latinos when it comes to family net worth?
Well, it's immense is really what it is. There's a lot of different ways to look at it, and every way that you do, it is a overwhelming disparity. For both black and Latino families, white families, on average, have about six times as much wealth. That's the average amount, and if you look at it in terms of the median, and that's the middle of the wealth distribution, it's even greater. I believe it's around 10 to 1 for white families to black families at the median. So it's really just every way that you look at it, it's a staggering, overwhelming disparity.
Well, Tim,
at the conclusion of the State of the Dream 2013 report, you make some recommendations about policy changes. And maybe you can first talk about how the Obama administration in the first 4 years, how well they've worked on housing policy, and what you would advocate for changes going forward over the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of housing policy, I think that it's on this, the second inauguration for Barack Obama, it's been very disappointing. The Obama administration came into office really when the housing crisis was beginning to full-scale epic disaster, and it really was. The level of foreclosures, the number of people losing their homes was staggering, and the programs that they put in place were frankly insufficient. And additionally, there was banks and lending institutions that were engaged in what frankly was illegal activity, and the prosecution of those has been fairly weak. There have been some settlements that have come out about faulty document filing practices and people who lost their homes, who were foreclosed, who shouldn't have been, who should have had opportunities to save their home. And the settlements, like I said, have been fairly disappointing. We highlight there's a lot of groups around the country that are working very effectively on those issues at the local level on the ground and fighting foreclosure. We highlight one of them that's up here in Boston, City Life Vita Urbana, who are really provided kind of a model for the country of blockading and preventing foreclosure and following through the legal process towards systemic change as well. And in terms of housing, there's a complex mix of various federal laws and state laws and local laws. We focus really on the tax expenditures related to housing more than anything else. At United for a Fair Economy, we have worked on taxes since our founding in the 90s, and there's a huge benefit for home ownership in the tax code, and the distribution where that benefit goes to is not where we think it should be going to as it pertains to housing policy in particular.
That was Tim Sullivan, policy coordinator with United for a Fair Economy and co-author of the State of the Dream 2013 report. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you can find links to download a copy of the report and additional commentary. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.